Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
All right. Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining today. Before we get started today, I just want to take a moment to talk about what happened at YouTube yesterday. Silicon Valley is a tight-knit community, and we all have a lot of friends over there at Google and YouTube, and we're thinking of everyone there and everyone who is affected by the shooting. Now, I know we face a lot of important questions, so I just want to take a few minutes to talk about that up front, and then we'll take about 45 minutes of your questions. Now, two of the most basic questions that I think people are asking about Facebook right now are, first, can we get our systems under control, and can we keep people safe? And second, can we make sure that our systems aren't used to undermine democracy? And I'll talk about both of those for a moment and the actions that we're taking to make sure that the answers are yes. But I want to back up for a moment first. We're an idealistic and optimistic company. And for the first decade, we really focused on all the good that connecting people brings. And as we rolled Facebook out across the world, people everywhere got a powerful new tool for staying connected, for sharing their opinions, for building businesses. Families have been reconnected. People have gotten married because of these tools. Social movements and marches have been organized, included just in the last couple of weeks. And tens of millions of small businesses now have better tools to grow that previously only big companies would have had access to. But it's clear now that we didn't do enough. We didn't focus enough on preventing abuse and thinking through how people could use these tools to do harm as well. And that goes for fake news, foreign interference in elections, hate speech, in addition to developers and data privacy. We didn't take a broad enough view of what our responsibility is, and that was a huge mistake. It was my mistake. So now we have to go through every part of our relationship with people and make sure that we're taking a broad enough view of our responsibility. It's not enough to just connect people. We have to make sure that those connections are positive and that they're bringing people closer together. It's not enough to just give people a voice. We have to make sure that people are not using that voice to hurt people or to spread disinformation. And it's not enough to give people tools to sign into apps. We have to ensure that all those developers protect people's information too. And it's not enough to have rules requiring they protect the information. It's not enough to believe them when they tell us they're protecting information. We actually have to ensure that everyone in our ecosystem protects people's information. So across every part of our relationship with people, we're broadening our view of our responsibility from just giving people tools to recognizing that it's on us to make sure that those tools are used well. All right, now let me get into a few specifics for a moment. With respect to getting our systems under control, a couple of weeks ago I announced that we were going to do a full investigation of every app that had a large amount of people's data before we locked down the platform, and that we'd make further changes to restrict the data access that developers could get. Ime Archibong and Mike Schreffer followed up with a number of the changes we're making, including requiring apps that you haven't used in a while to get your authorization again before querying for more of your data. And today, we're following up further and restricting more APIs like groups and events. And the basic idea here is that you should be able to sign into apps and share your public information easily, but anything that might also share other people's information, like other posts and groups you're in, or other people going to events that you're going to, those should be more restricted. So I'm going to be happy to take any questions about what we're doing there in a minute. I also want to talk for a moment about elections specifically. Yesterday, we took a big action by taking down Russian IRA pages targeting their home country. And since we became aware of this activity, of their activity after the 2016 U.S. election, we've been working to root out the IRA and protect the integrity of elections around the world. And since then, there have been a number of important elections that we focused on. A few months after the 2016 elections, there was a French presidential election, and leading up to that, we deployed some new AI tools that took down more than 30,000 fake accounts. After that was the German election, where we developed a new playbook for working with the local election commission to share information on threats we were each seeing. And in the U.S. Senate Alabama special election last year, we successfully deployed some new AI tools that removed Macedonian trolls who were trying to spread information during the election. So all in, we now have about 15,000 people working on security and content review, and we'll have more than 20,000 by the end of this year. And this is going to be a big year for elections ahead, with the U.S. midterms and presidential elections in India, Brazil, Mexico, Pakistan, Hungary, and others. So this is going to be a major focus for us. But while we've been doing this, we've also been tracing back and identifying this network of fake accounts the IRA has been using, so we can work to remove them from Facebook entirely. So this was the first action that we've taken against the IRA in Russia itself, and it included identifying and taking down Russian news organizations that we determined were controlled and operated by the IRA. So we have more work to do here, and we're going to continue working very hard to defend against them. All right, so that's my update for now. We expect to make more changes over the coming months, and we'll keep you updated. And now let's take some questions.
We will now open the line for a question and answer session. Please limit yourself to one question per person. To ask a question, press star followed by the number one. Your first question comes from the line of David McCabe from Axios.
Hello, everyone. Given that Colin testified, Jeff last year and more has come out since then, and given that the numbers at the time around the IRA operation changed so drastically, why should lawmakers, why should users trust that you're giving them a full and accurate picture now?
Of the IRA, I think that there is going to be more content that we're going to find over time. I mean, as long as there are people employed in Russia who have the job of trying to find ways to exploit these systems, this is going to be a never-ending battle. You never fully solve security. It's an arms race. And, I think in retrospect, we were behind, and we didn't invest enough in it up front. We had thousands of people working on security, but nowhere near the 20,000 that we're going to have by the end of this year. So I'm confident that we're making progress against these adversaries. But they're very sophisticated, and it would be a mistake to assume that you can ever fully solve a problem like this, or like that they're ever just going to give up and stop trying to do what they're doing.
Your next question comes from Rory Sullen-Jones with BBC.
You, back in November 2016, when you could say this crisis began, dismissed as crazy the idea that fake news could have swung the election. More recently, here in the UK, you've turned down an invitation to speak to our parliamentarians in the House of Commons, just as we learned tonight that 1 million UK users were affected by the Cambridge Analytica data leak. Are you taking this seriously enough, and can you convince British users that you care enough about the situation?
Yes. So we announced today that I'm going to be testifying in U.S. Congress, and I imagine that that is going to cover a lot of ground, and I'm going to be sending one of our top folks. It's either going to be Shrek, our CTO, or Chris Cox, the chief product officer. These are the top folks who I run the company with to answer additional questions from countries in other places. Oh, sorry. I should probably also address your you asked about my comments after the 2016 election. I mean, I've said this already, but you know, I think at this point I clearly made a mistake by just dismissing fake news as crazy, as having an impact. People will analyze the actual impact of this for a long time to come, but what I think is clear at this point is that it was too flippant, and I should never have referred to it as crazy. This is clearly a problem that requires careful work, and that since then we've done a lot to try to spread to fight the spread of disinformation on Facebook, from working with fact checkers to making it so that we're trying to promote and work with broadly trusted news sources. But this is an important area of work for us.
Your next question comes from Ian Scher with CNET News. Please go ahead.
Thank you. So you just announced 87 million people affected by the Cambridge Analytica stuff today. How long have you known this number was affected? Because the 50 million number has been out there for quite a while. I know you guys weren't specifically saying that, but it feels like the data just keeps changing on us, and you know that we're not getting a full forthright view of what's going on here.
So we only just finalized our understanding of the situation in the last, I think, couple of days on this. And and as you said, I mean, we didn't put out the 50 million number. I think that came from other parties in this. We wanted to wait until we had the full understanding. And just to give you the complete picture on this, you know, we don't have logs going back for when exactly Kogan's app queried for everyone's friends. So what we did was basically constructed what the maximum possible friend list is that people could have had over the time, and assumed that Kogan queried each person at the time when they had the maximum number of people or connections that would have been available to them. And that's where we came up with this 87 million number. So we wanted to take a broad view that is a conservative estimate. I'm quite confident, given our analysis, that it is not more than 87. It very well could be less, but we wanted to put out the maximum that we felt that it could be as soon as we had that analysis done.
Your next question comes from David Ingram from Reuters. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mark. I'm wondering if you can address the audits that you're doing for third-party app developers, and specifically, I hear what you're saying about taking a broader view now of the company's responsibility, but why weren't there audits of the use of the social graph API done years ago, back 2020, the 2010 to 2015 period?
Well, in retrospect, I think we clearly should have been doing more all along. But just to speak to how we were thinking about it at the time, as just a matter of explanation, I'm not trying to defend this now, is, you know, I think our view in a number of aspects of our relationship with people was that our job was to give them tools, and that it was largely people's responsibility how they chose to use them. So whether that's tools on how to share your voice, tools on how to log into apps and bring your information to them, you know, I think it was wrong in retrospect to have that limited of a view. But the reason why we acted the way that we did was because I think we viewed that when someone chose to share the data and then the platform acted in the way that it was designed with this personality quiz app, that our view was that, yes, Kogan broke the policies and he broke people's expectations, but also that people chose to share that data with him. Now, I think today, given what we know, not just about developers, but across all of our tools and just across you know, what our place in society is, it's such a big service that's so central in people's lives, I think we understand that we need to take a broader view of our responsibility, and that we're not just building tools, but we need to take full responsibility for the outcomes of how people use those tools as well. So that at least is why we didn't do it at the time, but I think knowing what I know today, clearly we should have done more, and we will going forward.
Your next question comes from the line of Cecilia Kang from the New York Times. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. Mark, you have indicated that you could be comfortable with some sort of regulation, and I think you alluded to potentially like political ads. I'd like to ask you about privacy regulations that are about to take form or take effect in Europe, GDPR. Would you be comfortable with those types of data protection regulations in the United States and indeed for your global users? Thank you.
So overall, I think regulations like the GDPR are very positive. And, you know, I was somewhat surprised by yesterday's Reuters story that ran on this because, you know, the reporter asked me if I was planning on, if we were planning on running the controls for GDPR across the world, and my answer was yes. So, you know, we intend to make all the same controls and settings available everywhere, not just in Europe. Is it going to be exactly the same format? Probably not. We need to figure out what makes sense in different markets with the different laws in different places. But let me repeat this. You know, we're going to make all the same controls and settings available everywhere, not just in Europe.
Your next question comes from the line of Tony Rahm from The Washington Post. Please go ahead.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for doing this. So in the blog post, you guys acknowledged that profile information had been scraped by malicious actors. Who are these actors? Are they political organizations like Cambridge or others? And given that, do you believe that this was all in violation of your 2011 settlement with the FTC? Thanks.
Yeah, so, I mean, to take a step back on this, all of the changes that I think we announced today were about ways that we built tools that were useful to a lot of people in sharing information or connecting with people, but that we basically felt like the amount of information that potential bad actors could get, or specific folks who we've observed, could potentially misuse this. So, so whether that's the changes around groups or events, where it's not unreasonable to have an API where someone can bring the activity in a group to an app. And be able to interact with that in a group, in an external app, we still wanted to shut that down because we felt like there were too many apps and too many folks who would have had access to other people's content, and that would be problematic. So it's a similar situation with search. You know, and what we found here is we built this feature, and it's very useful. There are a lot of people who were using it up until when we shut it down today. To look up the people who they want to add as friends but don't have as friends yet, right? Especially in places where there are languages where it makes it's easier to type in a phone number or a number than it is to type in more. A lot of people have the same name, so it's helpful to have a unique identifier to disambiguate. But I think what was also clear is that the methods of rate limiting this weren't able to prevent malicious actors who cycled through hundreds of thousands of different IP addresses and did a relatively small number of queries for each one. So given that and what we know today, it just makes sense to shut that down. You asked about the FTC consent order. We've worked hard to make sure that we comply with it, but I think the reality here is that we need to take a broader view of our responsibility, rather than just the legal responsibility. So, we're focused on doing the right thing and making sure that people's information is protected. And we're doing the investigations, we're locking down the platform, et cetera. And I think that our responsibilities to the people who use Facebook are greater than just what's written in that order. And that's what the standard that I want to hold us to.
Your next question comes from the line of Hannah Kuchler with Financial Times. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for hearing our question. So investors have raised a lot of concerns about whether this is the result of corporate governance issues at Facebook. Has the board discussed whether you should step down as chairman?
Not that I'm aware of.
Your next question comes from the line of Alexis Medrigo with The Atlantic. Please go ahead.
Hey, so you know, every company, big and small, balances the service they provide with the needs of the business. And so my question is, especially in light of, you know, Boz's post and your rethinking of Facebook's responsibility, have you ever made a decision that benefited Facebook's business but hurt the community?
You know, I'll answer your question, but first, because you brought up Boz's post, let me just take a moment to make sure that everyone understands that, you know, I disagreed with that at the time. I disagree with it now. I don't think that it stands for what most people inside the company believe. If you looked at the comments on that thread when he initially wrote it, it was massively negative. So I just think that's an important point to set aside. In terms of the questions that you asked, balancing stakeholders, you know, the thing that I think makes our products challenging to manage and operate are not the trade-offs between people and the business. I actually think that those are quite easy, because over the long term, the business will be better if you serve people. So I just think it would be nearsighted to focus on short-term revenue over what value to people is. And I don't think we're that short-sighted. All the hard decisions that we have to make are actually trade-offs between people, right? And one of the big differences between the type of product that we're building, which is, you know, why I refer to it as a community, and what I think some of the specific governance challenges that we have are that different people who use Facebook have different interests, right? Some people want to share political speech that they think is valid, and other people feel like it's hate speech. And then the questions, I mean, people ask us, okay, well, are you just leaving that up because you want people to be able to share more? I mean, these are real values questions and trade-offs, right, between free expression on the one hand, making sure that it's a safe community on the other hand, and making sure that we get to the right place. And we're doing that in an environment that's not static. Right, so the social norms are changing continually, and they're different in every country around the world. So getting those trade-offs right is hard, and we certainly don't always get them right. But to me, that's the hard part about running this company, not the trade-offs between people and the business.
Your next question comes from the line of Alyssa Newcomb from NBC News. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mark. You said you've clearly made some mistakes in the past, and I'm wondering, do you still feel like you're the best person to run Facebook moving forward?
Yes. I mean, I think life is about learning from the mistakes and figuring out what you need to do to move forward. And, you know, a lot of times people ask, you know, what are the mistakes that you made early on starting the company, or what would you try to do differently? You know, I think the reality of a lot of this is that when you're building something like Facebook that is unprecedented in the world, there are going to be things that you mess up. And if we'd gotten this right, we would have messed something else up. And I don't think anyone is going to be perfect, but I think what people should hold us accountable for is learning from the mistakes and continually doing better and continuing to evolve what our view of our responsibility is. And at the end of the day, whether we're building things that people like and that make their lives better. And I think that it's important to not lose sight of that through all this. You know, I'm the first to admit that we didn't take a broad enough view of what our responsibilities were. But I also think it's important to keep in mind that there are billions of people who love the services that we're building because they're getting real value and being able to connect and build relationships on a day-to-day basis. And that's something that I'm really proud of our company for doing, and I know that we're going to keep on doing that.
Your next question comes from Josh Constein from TechCrunch. Please go ahead.
Thank you. During today's disclosure and announcements, Facebook explained that the recovery and search tools using email and phone number could have been used to scrape information about all of Facebook's users. when did Facebook find out about this scraping operation? And if that was before a month ago, why did Facebook not inform the public about it immediately?
We looked into this and understood it more over the last few days as part of the audit of our overall system. And, you know, everyone has a setting on Facebook that controls, it's right in your privacy settings, that controls whether people can look you up by your contact information. Most people have that turned on, and that's the default, but a lot of people have also turned it off. So it's not quite everyone, but certainly the potential here would be that over the period of time that this feature has been around, people have been able to scrape public information, right? I mean, the information that you can, if you have someone's phone number, you can put that in, and then you can get, you know, a link to their profile, which pulls up public information. So I certainly think that it is reasonable to expect that if you had that setting turned on, that at some point in the last several years, someone has probably accessed your public information in this way.
Your next question comes from the line of Will Ormus from Slate Magazine. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much for doing this. You run a company that relies on people being willing to share data that is then used to target them with ads. We also now know that it can be used in more manipulative ways or ways they don't expect. We also know that you've been protective of your own privacy in certain ways. You acknowledge that you put tape over your webcam at one point. I think you bought the lot surrounding one of your homes to get more privacy. I'm curious, what other steps you personally take to protect your privacy online? Do you use an ad blocker? As a user of Facebook, would you sign up for apps like the personality quiz that folks signed up for? Thanks very much for having this.
I mean, I certainly use a lot of apps. So, I mean, I don't know if I use that one specifically, but I'm a power user of the internet here. I think it's in order to protect privacy. I would just advise that people follow a lot of the best practices around security. Turn on two-factor authentication. Change your passwords regularly. Don't have your response or the password recovery tools be information that you make publicly available somewhere. All the basic practices, and then, you know, just look out and understand that actually most of the attacks are going to be social engineering, and not necessarily people trying to break into security systems. For Facebook specifically, you know, I think one of the things that we need to do, and that I hope that more people look at, are just the privacy controls that you have. You know, I think especially leading up to the GDPR event, you know, a lot of people are asking us, okay, are you going to implement all those things? And you know, my answer to that is we've had almost all of what's in there implemented for years around the world, not just in Europe. So to me, the fact that a lot of people may not be aware of that is an issue that I think we need to do a better job of putting those tools in front of people and not just offering them. I would encourage people to use them and make sure that they're comfortable with how their information is used on our services and others.
Your next question comes from the line of Sarah Fryer from Bloomberg. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mark. There's broad concern that these audits for developers won't actually work, that the data that users gave to third parties years ago could be anywhere by now. What results do you hope to achieve from the audits, and what won't you be able to find?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, no measure that you take on security is going to be perfect, but a lot of the strategy has to just involve changing the economics of potential bad actors to make it not worth doing what they might do otherwise. So, you know, I think you're right that we're not going to be able to go out and necessarily find every single bad use of data, but what we can do is make it a lot harder for folks to do that going forward, change the calculus on anyone who's considering doing something sketchy going forward. And I actually do think we will be able to uncover a large amount of bad activity of what exists, and we will be able to go in and do audits and ensure that people go get rid of that data.
Your next question comes from the line of Steve Kovach from Business Insider. Please go ahead.
Hi. Has anyone been fired related to the Cambridge Analytica issue or any other data privacy issue?
I have not due to the Cambridge Analytica situation yet, but I mean I think we're still working through this. But look, at the end of the day, this is my responsibility, right? So I mean, there have been a bunch of questions about that, but you know, I started this place, I run it, I'm responsible for what happens here. To the questions before, I still think that I'm going to do the best job helping to run it going forward, but I'm not looking to throw anyone else under the bus for mistakes that we've made here.
Your next question comes from the line of Nancy Cortez from CBS News. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking the questions. Your critics say, look, Facebook's business model depends on harvesting personal data. So how can you ever fully reassure users that their information isn't going to be used in a way that they don't expect?
Well, I think we can certainly do a better job of explaining what we actually do. But there are many misperceptions around what we do that I think we haven't succeeded at clearing up for years. Right? So first, the vast majority of the data that Facebook knows about you is because you chose to share it. Right? It's not tracking, right? There are other internet companies or data brokers or folks who might track or buy and sell data, but we don't, you know, I mean, we don't buy and sell. But in terms of the ad activity, I mean that's a relatively smaller part of what we're doing. The majority of the activity is people actually share information on Facebook, which is I think why people are so people understand how much content is there because they put all the photos and information there themselves. The second point, which I touched on briefly there, is for some reason we haven't been able to kick this notion for years that people think that we sell data to advertisers. We don't. That's not been a thing that we do. It just goes counter to our own incentives. Even if we wanted to do that, it just wouldn't make sense for us to do that. So I think that we could certainly do a better job of trying to explain this and make these things understandable. But you know, the reality is the way we run the service is. You know, people share information. We use that to help people connect and to make the services better. And we run ads to make it a free service that everyone in the world can afford.
Your next question comes from the line of Matthew Braga from CBC News. Please go ahead.
Hey, Mark. I just want to go back to something that was brought up earlier around the scraping of profile information. I know Mike Schreffer in his post said that it describes sort of the scale and the sophistication of the activity. And I'm just wondering, can you put a little bit more context on that? Like, what sort of scale are we talking about? Do you have exact numbers? Can you give us any harder sense than sort of what's in that post?
Sure. I mean, so in terms of the sophistication, I mean, this is stuff that I've already said on some of the other answers, so I'll try to keep this short. But, you know, we had basic protections in place to prevent, rate limiting, making sure that accounts couldn't do a whole lot of searches. But we did see a number of folks who cycled through many thousands of IPs, maybe hundreds of thousands of IP addresses to evade the rate limiting systems. And that wasn't a problem that we really had a solution to. So now that's partially why the answer that we came to is that we should shut this down, even though a lot of people are getting a lot of use out of it. That's not something that we necessarily want to have going on. And in terms of the scale, I think the thing that people should assume, I mean, just given that this is a feature that's been available for a while, a lot of people used it for the right way, but there's also we've seen some scraping. I would assume that if you had that setting turned on, that someone at some point has accessed your public information in this way.
Your next question comes from the line of Rebecca Jarvis from ABC News. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for doing this. So Cambridge Analytica has tweeted now since this conversation began, and they said, when Facebook contacted us to let us know the data had been improperly obtained, we immediately deleted the raw data from our file server and began the process of searching for and removing any of its derivatives in our system. And I want to understand from you, now that you have this finalized understanding, do you agree with Cambridge Analytica's interpretation and the tweet that they've just shared? And will Facebook be pursuing legal action against Cambridge Analytica?
I don't know that. I don't think that what we announced today it really is connected to what they just said at all. What we announced with the 87 million is the maximum number of people that we could calculate could have been accessed. We don't actually know how many people's information Kogan actually got. We don't know what he sold to Cambridge Analytica, and we don't know today what they have in their system. What we have said, and what they've agreed to, is to do a full forensic audit of their systems so we can get those answers. But at the same time, the UK government and the ICO are doing a government investigation, and that takes precedence. So we've stood down temporarily to let the ICO do their investigation and their audit. And once that's done, we'll resume ours so we can get answers to the questions that you're asking, and ultimately to make sure that none of the data persists or is being used improperly. And at that point, if it makes sense, we will take legal action if we need to do that to protect people's information.
Your next question comes from the line of Alex Kantrowitz from BuzzFeed. Please go ahead.
Hey, Mark. Thanks so much for doing this. We should do this every month. This is great. So my question is that Facebook is really good at making money. But I wonder if your problems could be somewhat mitigated if the company didn't try to make so much. So you can still run Facebook as a free service and collect significantly less data and offer significantly less ad targeting criteria. So I wonder if you think that would put you and society at less risk, and if you think it's something you'd consider doing.
You know, people tell us that if they're going to see ads, they want the ads to be good. And the way the ads are good is by making it so that when someone tells us that they have an interest, right, if they like technology or they like skiing or, you know, whatever it is that they like, that the ads are actually relevant to what they care about. So, you know, like most of the hard decisions that we make, this is one where there's a trade-off between values that people really care about. On the one hand, people want relevant experiences. And on the other hand, I do think that there is some discomfort with how data is used in systems like ads. But I think the feedback is overwhelmingly on the side of wanting a better experience. You know, maybe it's 95-5 or something like that in terms of the preferences that people state to us and in their use of the product. So that informs the decisions that we make here to offer the best service to people. But these are hard values trade-offs. And I think we're doing the right thing to serve people best.
The next question comes from the line of Nancy Scola from Politico. Please go ahead.
Thank you. So, Mark, when you became aware in 2015 that Cambridge Analytica had inappropriately accessed this Facebook data, did you know that firm's role in American politics and in Republican politics in particular?
You know, I certainly didn't. You know, one of the things in retrospect, looking back at this, you know, people ask, well, why didn't you ban them back then? Right? We banned Kogan's app from our platform. We didn't ban Cambridge Analytica in 2015. Why didn't we do that? It actually turns out, in our understanding of the situation, that they weren't using any of Facebook's services back then. They weren't an advertiser, although they went on to become one in the 2016 election. And I don't think that they were administering tools, and they didn't build an app directly. So they were not really a player that we had been paying attention to. That's the history there.
Our last question comes from the line of Carlos Hernandez from Expansion. Please go ahead.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for the question.
Some more questions.
Thank you for the question, Mark. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that one of the main important things about Facebook is the people, and one of the biggest things around the use of these social platforms is the complexity of users understanding how these companies are gathering and using the information. Are you planning, with all the things that is happening, on letting users get to know better how Facebook is collecting their data and using it not only for Facebook but also for Instagram and WhatsApp and all the and the rest of the platforms that you are kind of responsible of?
So I think you're basically asking, you know, the systems are complicated, right? And there's a lot going on. How do people understand what's going on? Right? Is that a good summary of what you want me to speak to here? I don't know if you can answer that, so I'll just go. I think we need to do a better job of explaining the principles that the service operates under. But, I mean, the main principles are, you know, you have control of everything you put on the service. And most of the content that Facebook knows about you, it's because you chose to share that content with your friends and put it on your profile. And we're going to use data to make the services better, whether that's ranking newsfeed or ads or search or helping you connect with people through people you may know. But we're never going to sell your information. And I think if we can get to a place where we can communicate that in a way that people understand it, then I think we have a shot of distilling this down to a simpler thing. But that's certainly not something that we've succeeded at doing historically. We could take a few more questions if you want. I mean, it's go for 10 more minutes or something.
The next question comes from Kurt Wagner from Recode. Please go ahead.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for doing this. You guys have there's been the whole like delete Facebook thing that went around a couple weeks ago. There's been advertisers who have said that they are, you know, either going to pull advertising money or pull their pages down altogether. I'm wondering if on the back end, have you seen any actual, change in usage from users or, change in ad buys from advertisers over the last couple weeks as a result of all this?
I don't think there's been any meaningful impact that we've observed. But
sorry, this is Duncan McLeod here. The call's just disconnected. We're going to reconnect with the call with Mark Zuckerberg in just a moment. Please stand by.
What we're doing here. So the three basic categories are there are economic actors, or basically spammers. The second are governments trying to interfere in elections. So that's a security issue. And then the third is just polarization and sometimes lack of truthfulness in what you describe as the media, right? And in terms of people who are legitimately trying to get an opinion that they believe out there. So let me talk about each of these briefly. So for economic actors, these are folks like the Macedonian trolls who we identified with AI tools leading up to the Alabama special election. What these folks are doing is it's just an economic game. It's not ideological at all. They come up with the most sensational thing they can, try to push it out to social media and the internet in order to get you to click on it. That way you can make money. They can make money on ads. So if we just make it so that the economics stop working for them, then they'll move on to something else. I mean, these are literally the same type of people who would have been sending you Viagra emails in the 90s. Right, so we can attack it on both sides. On the revenue side, we make it so that that they can't run the Facebook ad network, right? And that's important because now they don't make as much money on that because the ad network works well for folks. On the distribution side, we make it so that as we detect this stuff, it gets less distribution and newsfeed. So now it just stops being as worth it for them to do this. So they kind of go and do other stuff, and we're seeing that that's working. The second category are these national security type issues, right? So that's the Russian election interference. And that one, rather than treating like spammers, you treat as a security issue. And in order to solve that, what we need to do is identify the bad actors. It's actually less about the content, because some of this stuff would have been legitimate speech had someone who is not a bad actor been doing it. But people are setting up these large networks of fake accounts, like the IRA had done. And what we need to do is just track that really carefully in order to just be able to remove it from Facebook entirely. And what we're seeing is the IRA and organizations like that are morphing, right? There are media organizations that are sanctioned news organizations in Russia that, when we investigate this closely over time, we're able to basically prove are completely owned and are controlled and operated by the IRA. So we take them down and treat that as a security issue. The third category is about legitimate media, right? So that's, and there, I think that there are a few different strategies. The first is doing more fact-checking. You know, to your question, in Mexico, we recently launched our fact-checking initiative in Mexico specifically leading up to the election. That's an important thing to do. We find that, you know, even though the fact-checkers aren't checking, you know, millions of things a day, we can show them the highest volume things, and that can both be used to show a useful signal in the product and to help inform rankings who just show the stuff less to people if it's a hoax. But then even beyond that, even for stuff that's not just broad hoaxes, there's still a big polarization issue, which is that, you know, often, even if someone isn't sending something false, they kind of are cherry-picking facts to tell one side of a story, and the aggregate picture ends up not really being true, even if the specific facts within it might be. And there, you know, I think the work that you need to do is about promoting broadly trusted journalism, the folks who people across society believe are going to take the full picture and show and basically do a fair job and thorough job. So that's the newsfeed change that we made there, which I think we've gotten relatively good feedback from people using Facebook on that change and the quality of what they're seeing. So those three streams, I think if we can do a good job on each of those, we'll make a big dent in the problem, not only for the Mexican election this year, but across the world, and that's basically the roadmap that we're executing.
Your next question comes from the line of Casey Newton from The Verge. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Mark, with respect to some of the measures you're putting into place to protect election integrity and reduce the fake news you just talked about, how are you evaluating the effectiveness of the changes you're making, and how will you communicate regarding any wins and losses in the run-up to and aftermath of the next elections?
So one of the big things that we're working on now is a major transparency effort to be able to share the prevalence of different types of bad content. Right, so right now, one of the big issues that we see is, you know, a lot of the debate around things like fake news or hate speech happens through anecdotes. Right, people see something that is bad that shouldn't be allowed on the service, and they call us out on it, and frankly, they're right, it shouldn't be there, and, you know, we should do a better job of taking that down. But what I think is missing from the debate today are prevalence of these different categories of bad content. Right, so whether it's fake news and all the different kinds therein, hate speech, bullying, terror content, all of the things that I think we would all agree are bad and that we want to drive down. And the most important thing, though, there is to make sure that the numbers that we put out are accurate. Right? So we wouldn't be doing anyone a favor by putting out numbers and then, you know, coming back a quarter later and saying, hey, we messed this up. I mean, I think part of the point of transparency is both to inform the public debate and to build trust. And if we have to go back and restate those because we got it wrong, then, you know, I think that the calculation internally is that it's much better to take a little longer to make sure we're accurate than to put something out that might be wrong. But I think that that's going to end up being the way that we should be held accountable and measured by the public. I think it will help create more informed debate. And my hope over time is that the playbook and scorecard that we put out will also be followed by other internet platforms, so that way there can be a standard measure across the industry about how to measure these important issues.
And the last question comes from Barbara Ortute with the Associated Press. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. So a lot of the things you've addressed recently are ways that, you know, malicious actors are already doing to misuse Facebook. So I'm wondering, what are you doing differently now to prevent things from happening and not just respond after the fact? So, you know, will this be built into your new product launches that you have to think about a possible misuse right away and not just once the product is out?
Yeah, I think, you know, going forward, I think a lot of the new product development has already internalized this perspective of the broader responsibility that we need to take to make sure that our tools are used well. And I can give a few examples across different work that we're doing. But, you know, right now, you know, if you take the election integrity work, for example, you know, in 2016, we were behind where we wanted to be. We had a a more traditional view of the security threats, right? We expected Russia and other countries to try to do phishing and traditional kind of security exploits, but not necessarily the kind of misinformation campaign that they did. We were behind. That was a really big miss. So now we want to make sure that we're not behind again. So, you know, as I mentioned in my opening remarks earlier, you know, since then there was the French election, the German election. You know, last fall there was the Alabama special election. And we've been proactively developing AI tools to detect trolls who are spreading fake news or foreign interference. And in the French election and the Alabama election, we were able to take down thousands of fake accounts. So that's an example of proactive work that we're now doing to get ahead, which gives me confidence that on that kind of specific issue around election integrity, we're making progress. It's not that there's no bad content out there. I don't want to ever promise that we're going to find everything or that we've beaten the enemies into submission, because I don't think they're still employed. They still have their jobs. We need to strengthen our system. But, you know, across the different products and things that we're building, I do think we are starting to internalize a lot more that we have this broader responsibility. And the last thing that I'll say on this is just that I wish that I could snap my fingers and, you know, in 3 months or 6 months have solved all of these issues. But I just think the reality is, given how complex Facebook is and how many systems there are and how we need to rethink our relationship with people and our responsibility there across every single part of what we do, I do think this is a multi-year effort. Now, that doesn't mean it's not going to get better every month, right? I think it will continue to get better. I think part of the good news is we really started ramping up on this a year ago or more. So we're not getting a cold start. We're probably a year into a massive three-year push. My hope is that by the end of this year, we'll have turned the corner on a lot of these issues, and people will see that things are getting a lot better. But these are just big. These are big issues. This is a big shift for us to take a lot more responsibility for how each of the tools are used, not just the developer platform, not just fake news, not just elections, but everything. And it's going to take some time, and we're committed to getting that right, and we're going to invest and keep on working until we do. All right. Yes. Thank you all for joining today. What we announced today were some of the changes that I think we need to make. We're going to keep on looking for things. We're going to keep on finding more. And we'll update you then. So thanks for coming in and joining and talking to us about this, and we look forward to keeping you updated with our progress soon.